Welcome to Healing with Worth, a podcast dedicated to healthy recovery and instilling hope in the wake of betrayal trauma. We are women who have experienced this intimately and want to offer hope to other women. While we may interview professionals on the show, the content should not be taken as therapeutic advice and is not meant to replace therapeutic healing. If you would like to join one of our free online Worth groups to help with your betrayal trauma, you may find us at healingwithworth.org. Welcome back to Healing with Worth. Janine and I are here today with a wonderful guest. Her name is Valerie Hammaker. She is an individual couples therapist with special training in trauma recovery, sexual health, and sexual addiction recovery, depth psychology, and issues of spiritual development. Valerie presents nationally on a variety of topics and most recently has turned her focus to tackling the issues of burnout from a depth psychology lens. She also has a podcast. It is called Generation Exhausted, and it's a weekly commentary on the recovery of burnout in marriage, gender roles, parenting, institutional religion, and body image. And she's recently launched an online community in her website, exhaustedgen.com, where she supports people in their burnout recovery journey. So welcome, Valerie. We're so glad that you're here to discuss some of these things with us today.
Hi, it's good to be here. Thank you guys for inviting me.
Our pleasure. We're excited to learn from you today. Yeah. We invited you on the podcast today because we wanted to discuss something with you that you mentioned you're very passionate about. That is how women can take ownership of their own development. I want to start by just asking you a little bit about your journey and kind of what led you to this passion and what you're currently involved in.
Yeah, that's a really good way to start. Thank you, Janine. Where to begin? I had an experience as a young mom. I'm a mother of four, and I loved being a young mom. I loved being a mother, but I felt unsatisfied in that I knew there was something else I was supposed to be doing. And so I had a lot of early grapplings with both wanting to be very involved in the lives of my children, but feeling deeply called to do something that was uniquely mine. I'm going to go ahead and just cry right out of the gate here. the moment my child, my youngest, was 4 years old, and I attended an event with a therapist, and it was all about healing, and I just knew that that was what I was supposed to do. I pursued that as soon as my youngest went into kindergarten, and every step of the way I feel has been guided by the divine. And that included at the end of my formal graduate training, an opportunity to get some more education and some additional credentials in sexual health. It was sexual addiction specific. And so I became very involved in that, which really felt more like a calling and it wasn't really my idea or passion per se, but it felt very important that I learn how to do these. And so I went through the process of learning that, started doing a lot of speaking and therapy in that realm. And then it became clear to me that it was important not only to talk about when sexuality goes wrong, but also how sexuality can go right and how it is deeply embedded in our divinity. And so it then expanded to more of a focus on sexual health, which then led me down the path of the depth psychology world, which is about psychological and spiritual wholeness, which is inclusive of sexual health, but it's also inclusive of all the other kinds of ways of being healthy as women and men. I hope that's kind of my, like, in a nutshell, how I became who I am today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So share a little bit more about this depth psychology lens that you often approach your clients with.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. The founder of this rather is a man by the name of Carl Jung. Many people have heard of him. He gets the credit for introducing spirituality into psychotherapy. He comes from Europe in the mid-1800s. And he's just an amazing, beautiful, brilliant thinker. And the essence of what he talks about is that the development of the soul is what brings about health in every other realm. And so it's less relationship oriented and more about when we become whole as a human being, we then enter into relationships such as marriage, such as parenting, such as the professional realm, really any other realm of our lives. When we bring the wholest versions of ourselves to those playgrounds, then we experience happiness, calm, and peace. And it's very empowering. It's a philosophy that I love because its whole premise is that we are whole already. Things happen. We have struggles. Stuff comes up. Life is messy, but that our innate divine is already healed. And if we can access that and tap into that and become the most whole versions of ourselves, because we are empowered to do so just by the knowledge that that is possible, then we enter into this place where we can become healed no matter what happens to us.
I love that. That is empowering.
It is. It's beautiful. That's why when I started studying it, I felt the spirit powerfully, like, oh, like this is it. This is, we are all broken. We're all wounded. We're human. We go through things, right? And as a psychotherapist, I see it all the time. And yet when I was able to capture our potential as innately divine, which of course I always knew, like conceptually, like, oh yeah, I've heard that all my life. But then it was like, no, this was different. This was deeper. And finally I was able to grab onto it and find a philosophy that was able to articulate what this really meant and how I could actually help people do this in their own lives, in their own individual struggles. I get to see people heal all the time because we are more powerful than we ever believed.
Oh, for sure. We do not live up to our potential.
Yeah, right.
And I love this concept of part of our sexuality is spiritual. And I don't think that as a 19-year-old, 20-year-old, 25-year-old, even adults do not recognize that.
It's so deeply embedded in our divinity, Janine, that we can't even begin to conceptualize it, especially when we come from traditions that are downright afraid of what it means to be sexual. There's such an orientation around prohibition and fear and anxiety around our sexuality that it's almost like a setup for us to misunderstand what it means to develop as a sexual human being and then to allow that part of ourselves to blossom in relationship, not only with our partners, but even become like embracing of the idea of ourselves as sexual beings independent of our relationships, part of who we are.
And I think there's, at least for me, there's been a real grieving process, understanding this part of our divinity and not being able to be safe in expressing it with mm-hmm. a partner because of betrayal and infidelity. It's quite psychologically difficult to work through.
Yes, 100%. I think if I may, as a therapist, when I work with couples who struggle with sexual issues, especially with someone who's struggling with looking at pornography and things of that nature, I'm always so conscientious of understanding the origins of their struggles and not seeing it as, this is going to probably kind of sound funny, my saying it, but sexual issues are not about sex.
Right.
They're about anxiety. They're about the inability to auto-regulate in adaptive ways. They're about fear of being seen, of being known, of being truly intimately received and giving of oneself. There's so many deeper issues than this idea of what we think about, like the one layer deep of what we see and experience as sex. And much of that comes from, you know, the way we've been socialized, the fear, and also, you know, of course, culture gets deeply involved in the problem.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, that makes sense.
Okay, so let's dive in to this topic of women taking ownership of their own development. And what are those areas? First of all, let's just address what those areas of development are.
I'm going to tweak that just a tiny bit because I feel that the areas of development are not gender specific, but I will say that the areas of struggle tend to fall sometimes a little bit more typically around gender lines, right? So I think we all, as we become healthier versions of ourselves, we are developing psychologically We're developing spiritually. We're developing in our capacity to communicate. These are actually areas of intimacy too, interestingly enough. You know, we develop intellectually. We develop in our capacity to share space with other people. There are all these areas of intimacy that we develop many times, you know, beginning at birth. And we're socialized by what is and is not okay by our families of origin, and especially our primary caregivers. And then sexually, of course, though sexual development is part of that. And the way I even teach my own children is it's just one part. It's one of many parts, and all of them matter. And none of them are embarrassing. None of them are less important than the other. That there are all these variations of self that we ought to honor and address and acknowledge and have a relationship with even from very, very young. And if none of those things are shamed, or if there isn't sort of a negative connotation on any of them, then we are able to move into, in our particular conversation, the sexual realm, and do so from, like, because we've been incrementally learning that it's okay to be our sexual selves from very, very early on. And many times women and girls are very much treated as if they are sexual objects and that men are the subjects of our sexuality. And that's something that comes up in culture. It comes up on billboards, in media. It's even something that is sort of implicitly communicated, even in the communications that we have, from like the expectation that boys are a certain way and that their sexual development and their longings are normal, but not so much if you're a girl. And also, I think that women sometimes really self-define as sexually pure, which is sometimes more like asexual, and that then they don't know who they are when they come of age and pair bond and it's time to sort of appropriately be sexual. They have absolutely no idea what that even means because they only know themselves and self-define as worthy because they are not sexual. I know I've just dumped a lot on you there. So
I know. Yeah, it is. But I love what you're saying, just because I have children, and what are some ways that you kind of combat that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important thing to be able to counteract. How do you do that as a parent? How do you do that as a mother?
Yeah, I love that question. So I will say, I'm going to offer to you what to do, not because it's what I did. I got this education and I actually became, I learned later on when my oldest was 11 was when I entered back into graduate school. And then of course the next 10 years plus have been really immersed in this. And so the good news for all of you out there listening who are like, oh man, like, is it too late? The answer to that question is a hearty no. Because I had little kiddos, and I'm going to speak in specifics about my daughters and some of the struggles that, well, I was trying to do my best by my little girls and sort of follow the culture. Ultra modesty would be a good one, right? Mm-hmm. Let me just speak into that for a second, because I do have a funny story that goes with that. We were very much like modest. And again, these are tricky conversations, because fundamentally modesty is a value that it's good, right? And right. Yet when we're managing our anxiety, because there's sort of a sexual undertone to our fear around modesty, that becomes problematic. So a good example of what not to do, I live in the Midwest, and well, like out in the West, it's hot in the summer. And I vividly remember that I was very strict to my daughters about how they dressed. And so what I did is I instilled in my children an anxiety around covering themselves up that was not healthy for their toddler and small little girl selves, to the extent, this is kind of funny, I was very adamant that they not show their stomachs in anything that they wore. And we had visitors over one day, and my daughter, who was a toddler at the time, ran through the house butt naked, covering up her belly button. And that, I wish, was more revelatory than it was. I didn't know better at the time. But what I had communicated is there's something grievous about showing the 2 inches of midsection, which is absolutely neutral. And I would go mm-hmm. so far as to say it's neutral in adult years too. I've really changed around that. There is nothing, and you know, the shoulders is the same thing. I paused not too long ago and I thought, what exactly is wrong with the half, you know, with the shoulders?
Mm-hmm.
That we have turned it into something that is sexually amiss. And it brings up in us as women trying to do well by the faith of our fathers and things like that. But it doesn't actually fit. There's not a lot of common sense around it sometimes.
Right.
And so what we're doing is we're teaching our children these lessons. They don't understand the whys. We actually sexualize a child's mind when we are turning something that is neutral, like a little girl's belly button, into something that brings up anxiety or some sense of prohibition in a toddler. And so to that, I would say, as a young mom, I wish I had been a little more chilled out, or maybe a lot more chilled out. And let that beautiful body just be a toddler body that ran around when it was hot in as little as possible. Right.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I wish I would have been a little more flexible and asked better questions about what is it that I'm trying to teach and why, and what is it actually communicating about the nature of her body as a child and moving forward, and really using my personal authority to be like, okay, I want to teach my child values. I want to teach her the sanctity of this beautiful body because it is in fact sacred. But if I go too far, I am actually instilling in this child and in this adolescent something that feels shameful about what it is to be a sexual person, somebody who's growing, you know, who's growing sexually, growing breasts and things like that. We start to become very uncomfortable with this thing that really we ought to be friendly with, because it's ours. It's our gift from God from the beginning, and it's ours forever.
Yeah. I love that.
I love that story too.
I know.
I think there's a lot of regrets that parents have about teaching about our sexual natures.
Yes.
I'm speaking for myself, is I certainly would be a different parent around that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So another question in regards to this, because this just seems where it's going right now.
Sure.
How do you shift that? So you said you learned this later mm-hmm. on. So how do you take the information and use it to shift like that asexual mind thinking?
Yeah. So as the girls and I have two daughters and two sons, so I'm getting a little taste of both genders. And as I have grown, and I think this actually runs, it's a beautiful offering of healthy emotional relationship too, which is that as I became wiser and understood the nature of my errors, I was very explicit with my children and would just say something to the effect of, you know, this is how Dad and I did it because it was what we thought was best, but we are learning to do differently. And so we're going to be different with you guys. And I mean, it's happening on the regular now that my kids are saying things like, we didn't used to do this that way or whatever, because they're experiencing us as less rigid and we're not throwing everything out. But yet at the same time, I'm a profound advocate, because this is a big piece of depth psychology. It's this idea of individuation, which is my inner divine is always drawn to truth and light. I can go directly to the source of truth anytime I want to. And to the extent that I know it's in there, I can find my answers with my heavenly parents. And so there are rules and regulations that come down through the church and things like that. And I appreciate those. And also, I have direct access to the divine, which then as a parent, I use that wisdom to discern what makes sense in the moment in my life and in the lives of my family and my children. And so it's really dignifying our own divinity to then say to our kids, you know, I thought that because I really was handing my own wisdom over to somebody else. I was letting somebody else be the captain of the ship. But guess what? Dad and I are the captain of this ship, and we are so grateful for the compasses. They help us.
Right.
We appreciate those. And also, in this particular situation, this feels right to us because we feel it inside of here. And so we teach children not only principles of modesty or principles around sexual health or how to honor their body and not be afraid of it, but we're also teaching them, it's a spiritual principle, because as we all know from the good teachings, you know, that we have, everything is actually spiritual in nature. And it's just a really beautiful way to help them see and experience that in real time.
I love that. All right. So let's shift a little bit. How does this look different for a woman who's been recovering from trauma? and especially when there's sexual trauma in the relationship that she's recovering from, how do you restore a sense of that divine sexual being within when it's been so abused?
That's the word I would use. I don't know if you would think differently about that, Valerie.
Betrayed would probably be the word I would use, but I think both work.
Okay.
I think the thing that I like to do, let me offer to you kind of the process that I walk through with folks that I work with. Generally speaking, I like to see the couple first, but sometimes that's not, you know, I kind of let it be organic and let it be whoever wants to come in first. I've had many occasions where I've just seen, I'm going to use the gentleman in this case as the person who struggles with the addiction, although I have seen many women too. So I want to be very clear in saying this is not a male, addiction is not a male issue, right? But in this case, we're talking about that. Okay. So I like to visit with the couples. I like to see what their innate resiliencies are as a relationship. And I think that really matters because I have seen both ends of the spectrum. I will give you for your show notes, the two episodes in my podcast from couples who have gone through profound recovery, and they've talked about it in detail in my own podcast. And it has been a transformative podcast for many people, both of the episodes. I wish I had those off the top of my head, but I don't. But in both of those cases, those couples had a rich, deep relationship that was fraught by the addiction or the struggle with sexuality that the husband had. And those couples, I was able to do a lot of really good work with, both in helping him understand the origins of his struggle and also helping her understand how she could become as healthy of an individual as she could, basically leveraging the struggles of their marriage to bless her growth individually as well as their growth as a partnership. Now, that would be different in a couple where I walk in and I see a couple who never really has had a foundation of strength, of friendship, of camaraderie, and where there really isn't much upon which to build. And I've worked with that kind of a couple too. And that is, as you may imagine, that's infinitely more challenging because we have betrayal, but there's not a foundation. And so that's a different kind of experience. That's not to say something can't be grown from scratch, but it's much harder, right? Because most of the time, the reason why a relationship has resilience is it's because the couple actually, at the end of the day, really quite likes each other. And then they have, you know, they have to work through the hard stuff. They've never really liked each other very much, and they got together for any number of misguided reasons, then it becomes much more challenging. It's so fracturing to a couple's sense of selfhood. Mm-hmm. When the sexual bond is betrayed.
Yeah.
So I don't know where I'm going with that, but
yeah, I think it's interesting, and I'm sure it's hard to answer specifics, especially when individuals are they're individual and they're unique. And so it makes it hard to give a blanket statement.
Yes. Let me jump back in, Naomi, because it occurred to me, I think I got off track a tiny little bit. Let me return to your question. Cause I was sitting there going, okay, what was I answering?
Oh, that's okay.
waxing profound here. Okay, so you were asking, what can the woman do to recover her sense of self, right? Or to work through the betrayal? So I think the foundation of that is to debunk a lot of the myths around, like, why did this happen? I think we're doing much better than we ever used to do around that topic, but it's not because she's not skinny enough. It's not because she's not having enough sex with him. It's not because of all of the things that I think used to be a little more commonplace as far as, like, the low-hanging fruit of, like, oh, it's just because of this, right? If only I had fill in the blank, then he wouldn't have fill in the blank, right?
Right. Right.
Good thing to understand is that, generally speaking, and I guess I'm just speaking from my own clinical population and some of the readings I've done, but most of the time the man brings this with him into the marriage. It did not start after they got married. I would say that's very rare, at least in my personal experience. Mm-hmm. And most of the time also, the man has struggled with this for reasons that it kind of depends on their age. If it's an older man, they often have struggled with pornography because they are auto-regulating around some sort of an emotional neglect history as a child. The younger gentlemen that are in their mid-30s and below, since, like, the internet has come about, oftentimes have really struggled with pornography because of just the sheer exposure. It's almost hard to not have some exposure to pornography once the internet really kind of took off. And so and these are all the things that I unpack during therapy. So I want the woman to understand the nature of his struggle so that she can distance herself from it being anything having to do with like some innate woundedness of her or something that she did wrong. And incidentally, there's a lot of work that I do with the couple to help them understand that even though she is very integrally a part of his recovery as a partner, there are certain things she's not a part of. She's not his police officer. She doesn't check his phone. She's not the follow-up person. She's not a sponsor. She doesn't need to offer him extra or any sex to mediate his struggle with not looking at pornography or masturbating. I mean, like, there's a lot of things that I'm very, very explicit about as far as like, what is your responsibility and what isn't.
Right.
And that comes down to sort of my depth psychology lens, which is how can I help each individual in this marriage become whole?
Right.
The responsibilities and what they each need to work on is certainly very, very different, but there is a responsibility in both sides of the partnership. As I dig into what his history is, and it's always also very interesting to know what her history is, and then to use the therapy and the addiction as a springboard for their growth. That's really how I see it. It's an opportunity for both partners to grow as individuals and then to use that growth to become more bonded in the marriage if they both decide to stay, and then to allow this to bless their lives.
Yeah, I think that's great.
As I've been thinking about how pornography affects the mind, there does seem to be kind of this lack of even interest in having sex. Yeah. I know for some men, that's not the case, but for some, it is. Mm-hmm. Maybe not lack of interest, but certainly lack of initiating this part of the relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you address that?
Sure. So I think that's a really good question, Janine. And that is one of the things that I would address in therapy. Maybe just to give you a little bit of context around what my thought process was as you were asking, is several things kind of popped up in my mind. One of them is that they may struggle with initiating because they are feeling, and this is not always the case, right? It can be different depending on the person, but I'm just talking about possibilities. Men may, especially covenant, like people that are trying to be, they're living a double life, essentially. They want to be someone who is making and keeping covenants, marriage covenants and things like that. And they're not. And there are many, if not most of the men I've worked with at the end of the day are really good guys. And they are so frustrated with themselves and they are just steeped in their own shame. And so they may associate sex with their wife as something that they are linking to the shameful hidden part of themselves. Mm-hmm. And so it's not about, oh, I don't like you. It's, I don't like me. And I don't like this part of me, this demon inside of me that I can't seem to overcome. The whole idea of sex with a partner is fraught with their own internal struggles. And I think to that, I would say, what I really, really spend a lot of time working with the gentleman around in this issue is that we have to really, really diffuse the shame. I have to help them understand that this does not make you a horrible person. This does not make you unworthy of the infinite and eternal love of the divine. And when they can start seeing their own innate worth independent of something that they struggle with, then the beautiful thing is that they begin to recover. Because when we link our selfhood with our weakest part, I don't care if it's pornography or anything else, it's paralyzing. Mm-hmm. And so when I help them see that you are not the product of your worst struggles, that you are innately divine already, and that even when you struggle, and even if this is a process, that you are always beloved, and that will never change. And I don't care what a church leader says. I don't care what anybody says. The biggest voice they have to battle is that one that goes on up in their heads most of the time.
Right.
I've sat with men who have literally wept as I have said those words to them, because that is incomprehensible to most of them. And when they begin to believe that, they begin the path of healing.
Which is, for women, that voice in our head, we battle with it and we struggle with it as well.
Yes.
As a woman is experiencing this, let's talk about what is helpful to her in helping overcome that voice in her head.
So to that, Janine, I would say that my work with the woman in this case is that she needs to relinquish control of his recovery, and she needs to really begin to believe that she is going to be okay with or without him. And I know that feels very scandalous to say,
but no, I really not at all.
Well, and it can be a really hard point to get to, mm-hmm, for a woman, especially in the culture that,
yes,
is almost dependent on her husband for a sense of safety and security.
Boy, I have a lot to say about this, Naomi. I feel powerfully that part of the problem is that we are socialized around a premise that is not conducive to a healthy marriage.
Yeah.
As crazy as that may sound, it sets up a paradigm where each partner has a role to play and they are dependent on the underdevelopment of their partner for them to be okay.
Right.
And so at the end of the day, guess what? We should all be providing goodness in the home, whatever that ends up being, however that is negotiated by the partnership. We should all be providing nurture. We should all become the best version of ourselves and use that inner divine to discern what that looks like as far as caregiving, parenting, employment, you know, task separation, how that looks in the home. The woman that struggles the most in this case is the one who is grossly underdeveloped. She generally has not enough education because she oftentimes gave up her hopes, wants, and dreams and desires to marry and start having children maybe too soon. I'm not saying that isn't a path that may be right for some women, but she cannot give that decision over to somebody else. That is hers and hers alone to make between herself, her partner, and the divine. And so oftentimes they're undereducated. Oftentimes they hand over the sort of the spiritual stewardship to their male partner because he's like the return missionary. So he's like the smart one. Like, do you see what I'm saying? And oftentimes they leave family and home and they are off to sort of create this world with their partner in some foreign land or country or state. They don't have the resources. And so they really are, in fact, set up in a very dependent position. And I also am pretty, I mean, I wait till I have a pretty strong relationship with these women that struggle, but I'm pretty direct as time goes by to say, and by the way, you colluded in this problem, right? You wanted to be the princess and he wanted to be the prince charming and his white horse whisking you away. And everybody thought it was a lovely idea.
Right.
But what it does is it creates very, very big problems down the road when she becomes so dependent on him that when he ends up having any struggle, and maybe this one in specific for our conversation, she feels completely disoriented because she does not know who she is separate from this identity that she's created as one down to him, to the extent that he is also, providing a way for her to do that. And so it's a setup where I really, as a therapist, I shake this up and it's like, I'm not saying that fundamentally any of those are wrong. If they're very, very intentional and the woman's development is paramount for the sake of the marriage, for the sake of her own soul's growth, and for the sake of the children. And then if that happens, even if something happens and something goes wrong, or the husband ends up being different than she thought, which, by the way, is always the case, no matter what, you know, we're always growing, right? She can know that she's going to be okay because she's not, her selfhood is not reliant on any other soul. But most people don't come into this arena with anything like that paradigm.
Right.
How does that feel, Naomi?
Feels completely accurate. I mean, I'm just looking at my own situation. I'm like, yeah, nodding my head. Yeah. Yeah, I get that. Yeah, I agree. I think part of it too is it's modeled. It's modeled. It's taught.
Yep.
In young women.
Yes.
And so you go into it thinking I'm doing all the things that they said I'm supposed to be doing, you know.
Absolutely.
Without really thinking about what I really desired, you know, make your little list of what you want in a husband and check all the boxes off and
yes,
and hope it turns out for the best. I would say in some ways, you know, some people are more dependent than others in the situation. I agree that I think being okay no matter what is really important. And that's something that I think I learned that early on in this healing process, that I will be okay no matter what, although it still presents difficulties.
Well, it's very scary. I mean, I think there's a difference between saying I want to be alone and I don't care. We're wired to want to pair bond and be with a partner. That's part of our divinity. There's a difference between I have a preference to be in a whole, uplifting, fun-loving, camaraderie-based marriage with somebody who I love, who's respectful, and where we have a sexual relationship that is uplifting because it's honesty-based. Who wouldn't want that preference, right?
Right.
Right. That's what we want. But there's a difference between that would be my preference and I will die if you keep betraying me because I don't know who I am if you're a sex addict, right? And I'm either beholden to you because I don't have the means by which to live by myself, or I'm beholden to you because I'm too scared to go out in the world because I don't know who I am without you at my side, right? And those kind of fear-based women, they actually, interestingly enough, absolutely sabotage the recovery of the person struggling with pornography, of the gentleman in this case, because they are holding him hostage to a process that does take some time. And oftentimes they are lapping on the shame to the man, which actually keeps him in the addiction. Her pulling back and being able to self-define and be okay, but also be loving and supportive, but be okay either way, actually opens him up to learn how to be okay himself and to work through his own shame, because most of these people are not without conscience. They get it. And they feel like they can recover because they're not doing it. Actually, ultimately, they're not doing it for her. They're doing it because it's what matters to them, because they're getting in touch with their own innate divine. And then they bring that better self to the relationship. And then those are the partnerships that actually heal really well.
I do like that. I think it goes along with this idea of there needs to be some individual recovery taking place before the couple can really come together and heal the relationship. Both people need healing. The woman needs to let go and let the husband do his own work.
100%.
I can see that, how that's so vital.
These are fundamental principles that apply beautifully in sexual addiction recovery, but by golly, they're not unique to sexual addiction. I do a lot. I do about 75% couples work in my clinic, and I sit down with them and I say, I've got news for you. You are here for couples counseling, but guess what we're going to do here? We are going to grow two beautiful individual souls who are then potentially, if each of you, you know, choose to participate, who are going to show up in really beautiful ways in this thing that you want to have together as a marriage. I'm not fixing communication patterns. I'm not helping them validate each other's, you know, like use the marriage to stay underdeveloped so that everybody can kind of feel comfortable. I don't do that. It's a very different kind of counseling. But the beautiful thing is, at the end of the day, we only actually have control over one human being. Even if we've made covenants, we cannot control the other side of the relationship. All we can do is make and keep covenants with the divine ourselves and grow our own souls. And the beautiful thing is, as we do that, we have this heightened potential to know what direction to go, whether it be to stay or go. And then our bad behavior doesn't justify their bad behavior. And either way, the individuals become stronger people, no matter what the outcome is. Even if someone chooses not to recover or can't, or it just becomes too painful, it's still a healthier soul that comes out of any experience like that and makes a deep commitment to heal themselves.
Yeah, I love that. I love everything that we have talked about so far. I hope that those of you who are listening have gained some insight and maybe connected things that maybe you hadn't connected previously. And stay tuned for our next episode. We are going to continue our discussion with Valerie. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for joining us this week on Healing with Worth. Make sure to visit our website, healingwithworth.org, if you would like to enroll in an online therapist-led support group. We'll see you next time.